Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Lady Up America podcast. I'm Diane Canada, your host, and so happy you're here today. I know this episode, like so many of the ones that we've been privileged to air, this is going to bless you today. Today, my guest is Dr. Carol Swain, and let me share with you a little bit about her background. I am so excited about this episode. So Dr. Swain was born into abject poverty in rural Virginia. She earned 5 degrees and obtained early tenure at Princeton and full professorship at Vanderbilt, where she was professor of political science and professor of law. Today, she's a sought-after cable news contributor, prominent national speaker, and a best-selling author. We're going to talk about her new book coming up here soon. In addition to 3 presidential appointments, Carol is a former distinguished senior fellow for Constitutional Studies with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, having also served on the Tennessee Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the 1776 Commission. An award-winning political scientist, she is cited 3 times by the U.S. Supreme Court. She's authored or edited 11 published books and numerous opinion pieces for major national publications. Her television appearances include BBC Radio and TV, C-SPAN, ABC's Headline News, CNN, Fox News, Newsmax, and so many more. She's the founder and CEO of Carol Swain Enterprises, Real Unity Training Solutions, Your Life Story for Descendants, and she has a nonprofit called Be the People. She's a mother, she's a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. She lives here in Nashville, Tennessee, in my neck of the woods, and she's just an amazing lady. If y'all would please welcome to the show, Carol Swain. Hi, Dr. Swain. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for being here. I know this is going to bless people. I want to jump right in. I want to announce to everyone first, because we want everyone to be very aware, and we want to say this several times throughout the program, you've got a brand new book coming out. And it's going to be available for pre-order as this episode is airing. And it's called The Adversity of Diversity. Love that title. Thought we would name the podcast that today, if that's all right with you.
That's fine with me. And thank you so much. We can talk about the book later.
There's so much I want to talk to you about. And we just had, I want to bring to a lot of people's attention. I'm sure that most of my listeners are aware, but I just want to read this real quick. We just had a pretty landmark ruling in the U.S. Supreme Court. And I know you have a personal story behind this that I want to get to first. Affirmative action, there was a case brought by Harvard, and I think it was North Carolina University, I believe it was, that where affirmative action was basically struck down in those schools. I've got a couple of quotes here. Chief Justice Roberts, who was a longtime critic of affirmative action, wrote in his opinion, he said, many universities have for too long concluded wrongly that the touchstone of an individual's identity is not challenges bested, skills built, or lessons learned, but the color of their skin. And he says, our constitutional history does not tolerate that choice. And then Clarence Thomas also, Justice Thomas also had a great quote on this. And he says, he sees the university's admissions policies for what they are, rudderless, race-based references. Those policies fly in the face of our colorblind constitution. So I would love just your perspective. If you could share with everyone, you've lived this, Dr. Swain. You've lived this. You've been really on the front lines of this discussion your whole life. So would you share with the ladies, just kind of take them on a little journey of where you've been with this?
Well, first of all, I want to talk about that Supreme Court decision. Race-based affirmative action in college admissions was struck down on the grounds that it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment of the Constitution protects all persons. And so I have felt for a long time and written about it for many years that race-based affirmative action, even gender-based affirmative action that discriminates against men, in many cases, it would violate the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that prohibits discrimination on account of race, sex, national origin, or religion. That has been expanded now to include handicapped people, and the Biden administration included LGBTQ. But the bottom line is, under our Constitution, people are not supposed to be discriminated against because of their immutable characteristics. And what's so significant about the case that struck down affirmative action that involved Harvard University and the University of North Carolina is that one is an elite private institution and the other is a public institution. And so the court said no, they would have to find another way to do their college admissions. And the problem was pretty serious. Whites and Asians were being discriminated against because of the color of their skin. And Asian students tend to have the highest scores. Their profile is a profile that is stronger if you were doing total merit than whites or blacks. And so it's significant that the private schools were brought into line. At public schools, we know that they are bound by the Constitution. Private schools have always felt that they could do whatever they wanted to do. So I think it was a great decision. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that it's going to mean that there will not be racial and ethnic minorities at elite institutions, because a lot of people don't know that those institutions have always had racial and ethnic minorities. Harvard University never discriminated against blacks. They admitted their first black student in 1870, and the first black PhD in America got his degree from Harvard in 1930.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're so right that most people don't know that. And this affirmative action is really a almost like a reverse discrimination. It's a reverse racial discrimination and favoring those minorities over accomplishment and merit and ability and all of that. You'll hear the argument a lot of times from the other side where they'll say, well, the people that that wouldn't normally have access to this education, they were in underprivileged neighborhoods and in underperforming schools and all of that. So they should have a chance. But what I've heard a lot of people say too, who went on and were accepted because of affirmative action, is they said they really struggled in those Ivy League schools.
Well, let me say this. The data on the Ivy League schools, the elite schools, is that they were not recruiting students from disadvantaged backgrounds, that the racial and ethnic minorities that they were favoring, 75% of them were the children of immigrants. And so they were not Black Americans. They were not descendants of slaves. And that's something that some Harvard professors have complained about. Some of the Black professors complained about the fact that they all came from affluent backgrounds. They looked very similar to the white students as far as their profiles. And they were the children of immigrants. Originally, affirmative action was to be about trying to address the effects of past and present discrimination. And it was linked to the descendants of slaves in America. After the early 1960s or mid-1960s, universities just started to recruit people that were part of the right racial and ethnic group, but they didn't care about their backgrounds. For the most part, they wanted students that would fit in and be comfortable. And so they went for the ones that came from more affluent backgrounds.
Right, Right. And it really is hard for someone to enter into any demographic, any world where they're not comfortable. They're going to perform better if they feel like they have something to contribute and they're really having that,
right,
that real opportunity. So you went on. So let's talk about you for a little bit.
Let's talk about me.
What's that old song?
That's my favorite subject. No, that's not. God is my favorite subject, but as far as my background, it is relevant. Yeah. So I was one of 12 children, born and raised in rural poverty in southwestern Virginia, spent the early part of my life in a two-room shack, married at age 16, had my first child at age 17. And by the time I was 21, I had three small children. And two people in particular entered my life that were responsible for changing my life. One was a medical doctor who was Caucasian, and it turns out, and I only found this out a few years ago, that he was 5 years older than me. And he told me that I was intelligent, I was attractive, I could do more with my life. And after the conversation with the doctor, I decided to get a high school equivalency because, again, I was a high school dropout. So I got my high school equivalency and I started taking jobs outside my home, outside the house. I worked in a garment factory. I sold smoke detectors from door to door. I sold Avon. A lot of women of my generation sold Avon.
Oh, yes.
And I worked in nursing homes. And while I was in one of those nursing homes, an African orderly told me I ought to go to college, that he went to college with a lot of people who were not as smart as I was. I ought to go. And so I checked into it and was able to go to the community college and earn a two-year degree in business. And so that's how I got into college. And I started my college education in 1976. By then, affirmative action had been around for a while. And affirmative action was never the law of the land in the sense that Congress passed legislation and it was signed by the president. It came from executive orders. The first one was 1961, John F. Kennedy, and then in 1965, I believe, Johnson signed an executive order, and then Nixon signed his executive order that instituted quotas. The quotas were struck down by the Supreme Court. But going back to the community college, when I got admitted, anyone could get admitted to a community college. You didn't need a high school equivalency. I had a high school equivalency, and when I took the test, I was told that I had one of the highest scores they had ever seen. And in some areas, I was in a 98th, you know, the 90th percentile.
Wow.
I have to tell you that I barely passed math. And math is something, like, I missed a lot of school as a child. I failed three grades as a child because we didn't go to school very often. There were some years we missed 80 of 180 school days. And so math is not a subject that you can not go to school and not be taught and be good at.
Yeah.
You know, there's something that I can tell you, I can attest to the fact that when we went from arithmetic to algebra, I missed something.
So. Well, I want to tell you, I had school all my life and in algebra, I failed it twice. So
not my jam. So, you know, with the math, that was something that I always struggled with. But going back to the community college, so I got admitted to the community college. There was not affirmative action. Community colleges have always had open doors. They give you your second chance. And someone like me, or maybe there may be some people in your audience that dropped out of school, mm-hmm. go to a community college. Mm-hmm. But I went in, I had a high school equivalency at the time, and I did really well. In fact, I didn't study very hard and I was making C's the first year. And I took remedial math because I needed to take remedial math. Mm-hmm. And the second year I thought, well, I wonder what would happen if I studied. I made the dean's list.
You made the dean's list. I wonder what would happen.
Well, here's my reasoning, folks. I thought C's were good because it meant you were average. And I was a high school dropout. I dropped out after the eighth grade. And so for me, average was good. Mm-hmm. But then I decided, I wondered, you know, what would happen if I studied? And I never planned to get 5 degrees. I had 5 degrees. That was never my plan. So my first degree is in business. My second degree is in criminal justice. I chose that field because it had the least amount of math. And
I've heard your story many times. I never heard that part. That's interesting.
And I wanted to be an honors student. I had decided, because I applied for jobs, I was going to be a store manager. I was going to manage one of those little boutiques at the mall. And I applied for jobs, and I was told that I needed a four-year degree. And, you know, like, I don't know if that was true, but that's what they told me. And so I listened, and I decided that I was going to get a four-year degree, but I also decided, I made the decision I was going to be an honor student because I needed to distinguish myself. I had filled out a lot of applications, and they had places for awards and accolades, and I didn't have much to put there. I had made the dean's list a couple of times, but that's all I had. So I knew I had to distinguish myself. And so when I went to get the four-year degree at Roanoke College in Salem, Virginia, I made the decision ahead of time that I was going to be an honor student. And at that time, I was working full-time, 40 hours a week at the community college library, nights and weekends at a job they created for me because they couldn't get other people to work nights and weekends. I went to school full-time. I worked full-time. And I have to confess, no one used the library nights and weekends. And so I did my homework.
Yeah.
And so I graduated magna cum laude with that degree in criminal justice, did not want a criminal justice degree, career. And while I was there, I made the highest honor societies. I did not join the Black Student Union. I did not do anything but join honor societies, keep my head down. I won the criminal justice prize for the highest GPA in criminal justice. And I went to Virginia Tech to get a master's in political science because I thought I was going to work for the government. And while I was there, professors pushed me and urged me to continue my education, get a PhD. I was not interested. I was shy. I had been shy all of my life. There was no way that I was going to stand up and teach a class. And, you know, I'm not sure that I was ever meant to be a teacher in the sense that I was so shy. I would forget my name. And the idea of turning my back to a class and writing on the blackboard, and my vision of a great teacher is someone that goes to the blackboard. They have such flair and they do all this stuff and they draw these circles. And that was not me. And it's kind of still not me. But at any rate, recession of the 1980s, it was there. And I applied to graduate school, got admitted immediately to the University of North Carolina. They gave me a great stipend. I also applied to Duke. And from Duke, I got a call from the graduate director, and he said I had a great profile, but that he thought Carolina would be better for me because Duke was a upper white, rich white boys party school, and that I would feel more comfortable at Carolina. And I was so pissed off. I made them give me back my application fee, which I think was $40. And then later, when I went to the University of North Carolina, and I became a hotshot student, highly sought out across the country, because I did whatever professors told me to do to be successful. So I gave conference papers. I worked with professors on articles and things. I did everything they said. So I was a hot commodity. And then later, Duke tried to recruit me. And I did take a fellowship there. I went there for 1 year, but they tried to hire me as a faculty member.
I bet
member.
They did.
they wanted me to apply for a minority position where at that time, and they still may have them, they would advertise a job and they would have three Black folk compete against each other. And I refused to do that. And Princeton did not do that to me. And other schools, everywhere I applied for positions in American politics. I was a congressional scholar. I wanted to compete with the best. And so when Princeton hired me, they told me that they had looked at over 200 applications and I was the best qualified. Mm-hmm. And the chairman of the department said the only way he thought I could fail at Princeton was if I was in an automobile accident and my brain was outside my head.
Wow.
And so that was the circumstances. And so all this is happening during an era when there was a heavy emphasis on affirmative action and recruitment, but the people who hired me were the conservatives at Princeton. The liberals at Princeton did not like me. They did not want me. And I think it was because of my pedigree. Yeah. I did not come from the middle class. I mean, I came from dirt poverty. Mm-hmm. People like me are not supposed to happen. We are not the people those institutions recruit. Mm-hmm. And I'm a believer in God. I was not a person of faith back then. I was more of an agnostic. But only God, with his sense of humor, would have taken a person who was as poor as I had been and place them at Princeton and allow them to get early tenure. Because when they hired me, I told them that I was going to get early tenure. I was going to do it in 3 years. And I had my life planned out. I was going to do my tenure in 3 years instead of seven. Seven is the normal length of time. I was going to be a full professor in 6 years. And in 10 years, I was going to have a cabinet position. And then I went up in the third year, got my tenure, and with the and during the time I was there, there was the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill mm-hmm. hearings. And when I watched that, I decided no way would I ever open my life up to a congressional mm-hmm. hearing. And so that's my backstory. So I became of age during the affirmative action era, but I never wanted to be an affirmative action, quote, baby. Mm-hmm. And I worked harder because I wanted to show what I could do. And I always had, I'll show them mm-hmm. attitude. But along the way, I encountered many white males that said to me, oh, you have it made. You a twofer. And back then, if you were Black and you were female, they called you a twofer. And that meant that you were in two categories. And I had white men tell me that if they were Black, they would have a job. So that's my background, and that's my affirmative action story. And with Princeton, my first book, when they hired me, I had a Harvard University Press contract on my dissertation, and I had a National Science Foundation grant. And that book won 3 national prizes, was cited by the Supreme Court, and I won the Career Award for Political Scientists, and I was the first Black to win it and the second woman. And so, you know, like, did they know I was Black? Yeah, they saw that I was Black. Did they give me affirmative action? I didn't ask for it. Right. If someone favored me because of my package of who I am,
yeah,
there's nothing I can do about what was going on in their heads, but I always tried to excel.
Yeah. So there's a few things I want to unpack, and I know we're on limited times, but I have to touch on a couple of things. What I always pick up from when I hear your story is, one, that you had 2 incredible mentors that completely altered your trajectory. So that early doctor and then that second mentor. So I think the mentorship is so big. Let me say this about them.
They were not mentors. They were people that probably don't remember a conversation where they were one-liners. And so the lesson that I get from that is that words can change lives. There may be strangers. For everyone out there, you don't know whose life you changed. That doctor, that was one encounter in the hospital where he told me I was intelligent, attractive, I could do more with my life. I'd never heard that before. He found out maybe 5 years ago that he changed my life. He didn't know what happened to me. Wow. And then the African orderly, he just said in the break room, you ought to go to college. I go to school for a lot of people that that aren't as smart as you are. I took the words and I ran with it. They planted the seed.
Yes, planted that seed. So I didn't realize that you didn't have more than one encounter with them. So that's even more powerful, that just being told that you can, just that you can, you know, I think people are just so hungry for those words. So one of the things I was saying recently on a program, I was talking about this subject, and I said, you know, when we accept the idea that we are a victim, we become our own oppressor.
That's true. And you know something? I was not raised to see myself as a victim, even though we were poor. My mother would not take free lunches or free books or anything during that era. Mm-hmm. And I did hear all of my life from everyone around me that if you work hard, you get an education, you can make something out of yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I did not even know I was oppressed until I got to graduate school.
I love that. And you know, God, like, I know your faith is so strong. We share that. And you know, our God makes a way where there's no way. you know, he put those people in your life that told you that. So that was the mentality you had. And then when you heard those words, those seeds were planted in your heart by two people, you know, you took those words and ran with them. He even made the path for you to be able to study in the library. I mean, a quiet library where you could get that study.
So many things. I could take my children to work. I can tell you that I did not know God until I was in my 40s. That's when I got saved. But after I got saved, it's like God took me backwards on a journey. And he showed me where he was in so many situations. And I also struggled with depression and suicide gestures. And there were all kinds of things that I struggled with. He also sent people in my path that told me, you're going to be famous someday. Do you know you're going to be famous? At the time, I was not doing, there was nothing about where I was or what I was doing that it made sense.
Yeah.
But I grew up with a sense of urgency, always feeling like, there's something I'm supposed to do. Something I'm supposed to do. But then my circumstances, I got married, I had children, but there was always that sense of there's something I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
And even when I was in academia, I went through a period, many years I told people, I feel like I'm training to do something I've never done before. Little did I know that what I'm doing now is the thing that I've been training for all of my life.
All of your life. Oh my gosh, Carol, I say that so often too. Like you just know there's, you have this sense inside of your spirit that there's just a higher call on your life. And yeah, you look around, you're like, why would God choose little on me? And I loved when you said that earlier, that it just would, you know, astonish the, you know, so many people, but that's what our God does. He confounds the wise. I mean, he takes the people that would be the most unlikely in the world's eyes. And but that's where we can glorify him. And you do that. You do that all the time. You're always putting that credit where it belongs, which is in his lap. And we are just the vessels doing his work. And he's pulling his kids together here to do his work for such a time as this. And I just admire you so much for how you have just pushed through. You have stood up. You have believed in yourself. You've received those words. I think a lot of times people have a hard time receiving those seeds, you know, and letting them grow, letting God grow them in our hearts. And you did that. And you're just going on now to be such an important voice, like I said, for such a time as this. Let's talk in our last, we've got about 3 minutes here left.
Well, just one thing.
Oh, sure.
You quoted my life, one of my life verses that the Lord gave me when I got saved. First Corinthians verses 26 through 27 about how God takes the lowly things to confound the wise, the weak things to confound the mighty, so that no flesh might glory in his presence.
Yes.
That is one of the scriptures that the Lord gave me.
Wow. I know he's right here in this conversation. And so we can always just see his fingerprints everywhere. And I love to watch him work. He is a master. He's just the master. Let's talk about your book here in the last couple of minutes. So we are going to be so excited to see this book in bookstores. So we're looking at pre-orders here this week. So we're thinking this first week of August, you guys can go to your bookstores and pre-order Dr. Swain's new book, The Adversity of Diversity, How Real Unity Training Can Promote Healing in a Post-Affirmative Action World. So we'd rather you guys go. We all know that there's so much going on with, you know, big tech and big media and a lot of these big corporations, so Amazon. So we really want to drive people to go actually down to the bookstore and order it there, as opposed to just waiting on it to come out on Amazon. But can you give people just a sneak peek of what they're going to read? And I mean, I know we've talked about a lot today.
Yes.
That I'm sure will be in there.
What we didn't talk about was DEI. And
yes.
I want the viewers to know that 90% of the book was drafted before the Supreme Court issued its decision, because I had a gut feeling that they had to strike down affirmative action because it violated the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It was at odds with the civil rights laws. And I argue in the book that DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and CRT has to fall for the same reasons.
Yes.
And so the first chapter talks about the history of affirmative action. The second chapter is about my own journey through an affirmative action infused environment. I share some of my stories. Chapter 3 looks at the corporate world, the conundrum posed by all of these DIE programs and trainers, and just how they kind of destroy the institution and the organization. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter about George Floyd and how his martyrdom allowed the DEI people, it gave them upper hand. It got BLM into many corporations. And then the last chapter introduces my company, Real Unity Training, and what it has to offer. And I feel like the Lord gave me the vision for Real Unity Training because the idea was birthed during the summer of 2020 when I had to speak at a conference about the race riots, the violence that was taking place across the country. And the night before I was to do it, I heard clearly in my spirit, and those of you who are believers know what I mean, unity training. And so I jumped up, purchased the domain name Unity Training Solutions. And at the end of 2020, I incorporated my idea as a business. And it really is focused on helping CEOs and owners and supervisors, giving them the language, the skills, the tools that they can use as an off ramp for DEI, because DEI does the opposite of what it says it's going to do. Yes. It disrupts the workplace. It's based on a conflict-based model of Marxism. And what we need in the workplace is people to return to the mission of the organization, its mm-hmm. purpose. Why was it created? And just like with college admissions, you can have diversity without the divisiveness. And you don't have to have DEI programs to have racial and ethnic minorities that are integrated into the organization, that are excelling. And for people that are high achievers, for racial and ethnic minorities that are high achievers, affirmative action has really been an embarrassment, and it's diminished their accomplishments, because no matter how strong you are, no matter how brilliant you are, people will say that everything you accomplished was because of affirmative action. They think someone handed it to you. Most racial and ethnic minorities are just like members of the majority group. That's not what we want. That's not who we are. That's not what we're about.
That is such a great point. I think that is a point to conclude on. I couldn't possibly say anything after that. That was brilliant, brilliantly put. Dr. Swain, you are a treasure. And it has been an honor having you today. Thank you for visiting with me.
Thank you. And hope to do it again sometime.
Yeah, we sure will. All right. Thank you so much. And for all of you watching today, please make sure that you go and pick up Dr. Swain's book, The Adversity of Diversity, How Real Unity Training Can Promote Healing in a Post-Affirmative Action World. Y'all go get it at the bookstores, okay? And not on Amazon. Go get it down there. All right. Thank you so much for being with us, and I'll see you next time. Have a great day. Victory on the battleground. We claim it now. Doom and gloom.